Hello and welcome to another episode of Unleashing the Doctor Within. I'm MS2 Sam Wilkinson, here with fellow University of Utah School of Medicine student Bridger Battaglia. And today we're joined by Dr. Hull. Dr. Hull, I think your description of your career is exactly where we should start. Tell us a little bit about your journey.
Okay. Well, I'm a graduate of the University of Utah School of Medicine in 1985 and then completed a residency in OBGYN at this same institution. As I finished my residency, decided to go into private practice here in the Salt Lake Valley. And I practiced for 10 years as a general OBGYN. Things were going pretty well. Had a good family, a supportive wife, and four sons at home. And then on a July day in 1999, I failed to complete a backflip on a trampoline. Did a half a backflip, actually, and ended up dislocating the fifth cervical vertebrae over the top of the fourth and sustained a significant spinal cord injury, which left me paralyzed, both motor and sensory paralysis from the neck down. So entered the world of spinal cord injury and paralysis suddenly and unexpectedly. And so that began a long, different journey for me in terms of, you know, where I am today. I spent 2.5 years doing rehab full time. I was fortunate to have a fairly quick return of neurological recovery early on, to everybody's surprise. But I had to convert that neurological recovery into functional ability. And that's where expert rehab played a huge role for me. So at 7 months after my accident, I was getting my PT and OT at home because of my disability, but was very frustrated by the fact that the insurance restrictions keep the therapist limited to about 50 minutes of therapy per session. And you typically only get 20 sessions per year. And those outpatient benefits are not any different than if you blew out your ACL or you have a total knee or total hip or you have a rotator cuff tear. You get the same amount of outpatient benefits. So I was a little frustrated because I'd had all this neurological potential and I just wanted to convert that as much as possible into ability. Well, about 7 months after my accident, and granted, it's not the therapist's fault. I mean, they can only do what they can do within the limitations. But 7 months after my accident, my PT went on vacation, and a physical therapist named Jan Black drew the short straw, literally, and had to fill in. Because she was told to go in and take care of this SOB doctor who wanted to dictate his own care. And she was like, oh my gosh, okay. And the first day that we worked together was a disaster for both of us because she was told to come in and say, what do you want to work on? And as soon as she asked me that, I was disappointed because in my mind, I was thinking, well, if you don't know, who knows? So I felt like I had to be the one to take over. And that's why I got that reputation of wanting to dictate my own care. So she literally left my house and called her supervisor and said, I'm either not going back or I'm going back on my terms. And fortunately, she showed up the next day, sat on the edge of my bed and said, look, we're all a little bit different. You're only going to have to put up with me for 4 days. Will you let me just do my thing? And I said, yeah, knock yourself out. And within 30 minutes, it was like a godsend, and I realized this person was going to be the key. So, you know, I ended up getting my insurance company to pay her for everything, PT, OT. I paid her privately, and that ended up being a 2.5 year journey of doing therapy several hours a day, 5 days a week. And that all culminated with me having the opportunity to carry the Olympic torch in the 2002 Winter Olympics when they let ordinary citizens carry the torch.
Tell us a little bit about that story. You told us a little bit at the lunch that you came and spoke for us, but I think it's an awesome story about how you kind of just grabbed the bull by the horns and made that happen.
Well, so as I was making progress, well, first of all, you have to go back and you have to understand that I was never with a person in the hospital to say, oh, I'm going to walk out of the hospital. I mean, I knew how bad my injury was. So when I was initially in rehab, I said to my wife, I will work as long and as hard as I can to have one arm to drive the joystick of a power wheelchair. That was my only goal, just to have one arm. And as I started to accomplish that goal, then I set other goals, and it just kind of kept creeping along. And
didn't you only use the motor wheelchair the one time?
Well, I was in it one day.
Yeah.
The power wheelchair one day.
Yeah.
Because then I said, okay, give me a manual chair. Because I made that goal.
Yeah, on to the next goal.
Right. But I figured if I just stayed in the power chair, I wouldn't make any more progress. So I had him give me a manual chair. And in fact, the funny story about that is I had my wife go buy football receiver's gloves that are sticky. Because I don't know if you know, they have quad gloves that have leather on them. So you put these leather gloves on to help you push the chair. But I didn't have enough strength. So in my mind, I'm like, I need more friction. So I actually bought receiver gloves and cut the fingers off so that I could push the manual chair. Anyway, so as I was making progress with Jan, about 2 years into my recovery, I knew I needed a new goal. And by then I was walking with arm crutches, but I needed something to shoot for. Well, it was then that I found out that the Olympic committee, the organizing committee, they were going to allow ordinary citizens to carry the Olympic torch, but you had to be nominated to be a torchbearer. So I nominated myself, and then I actually campaigned, and I had everybody I knew send in my name. So I had this little campaign going, and so I was thrilled when I received the letter that said, yes, you'll be a torchbearer, but it was going to be 6 months from when I received the letter. So I had about 6 months to prepare, and I said to Jan, okay, I'm going to be a torchbearer. I don't want a cane. I don't want crutches. I don't want a walker. I don't want to be in a wheelchair. I want to carry the Olympic torch with my own hands, walking, and if I can, I want to run.
And where exactly were you physically when you made that goal?
Six months out. I had two Lofstrand arm crutches.
Okay.
We were still working on my hand and finger function.
Okay.
So I still had trouble gripping with my right hand. And because of loss in sensation, that's a big issue. Because I knew I was going to have to carry a 3.5-pound Olympic torch.
With gloves on
yeah. In the cold.
Yeah.
Because cold really affects my function. So we had a lot to do. And my goals became Jan's goals, became our goals. And she kind of said, okay, you know, let's get started. And so I think the benefit that I learned from that is, you know, you can do rehab day after day after day. But unless you have a new horizon that puts meaning in what you're trying to do, now the whole game changes. And it's like I tell people, you can sign up for that gym membership and you go to the gym, and after a few weeks, you're like, I'm just going to the gym. You sign up for that half marathon in April, you're going to the gym because you have something to work for. So I do think, you know, you hear about SMART goals. I do think there's something about setting a goal that makes you realize what's your vision. Where do I think I can get? And then that really is a motivating factor. Anyway, so that's how I got to be an Olympic torchbearer. And so on February 8th of 2002, which was the last day of the Olympic relay, I had my 15 minutes of flame and carried the Olympic torch in Salt Lake City.
That's awesome. And didn't you hand it to Karl Malone?
I did. He wasn't supposed to carry the torch, but at the last minute he got put in my segment and they moved me back one segment. And I didn't know it until the day of that's who I was going to pass it to.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was fun.
That's really cool. And so what was your next goal? What was your new horizon after carrying the Olympic torch that kept you moving forward in your rehab?
Because I still was partially paralyzed and didn't have normal sensation, I realized I couldn't go back to practice. I actually thought about it. I even tried a couple of days kind of in the clinic thinking, you know, maybe I could do infertility work or something. But it just never felt right. And at the same time, I had met a lot of other individuals with paralysis, and they saw what was happening with me. They wanted Jan for their therapist. Jan had always wanted her own clinic because she knew or felt like there was a better way to do this. So we started talking. Is there something we can do to help these people? And eventually we said, well, if we're going to be serious about it, let's put our thoughts down on paper. So literally we wrote a business plan. I had a nephew at the time who was in MBA school, and it was kind of funny that I called him up. It was in early January. I called him up and I said, are you in MBA school? And he goes, yeah. I said, well, don't you need a project? And he goes, yeah, we're supposed to write a business plan this semester. And I said, well, I have an idea for you. And he was so excited because the default was that they had to write a business plan to open a retail store. And he works in healthcare, so he loved the idea. So he actually helped write our business plan. And so we had that all down. We knew we were going to do it as a nonprofit. And then suddenly the opportunity was kind of thrust upon us. And so in 2004, Jan and I put $500 in the bank. We'd already registered the nonprofit. We rented a space, 1,000-square-foot space, and we said we're a spinal cord injury recovery center. And Jan was our only therapist, and there were about a dozen individuals who came for therapy. And we said, okay, let's see if we can make it work.
Wow. So how did you get from that one clinic, one therapist, $500 to where we are today and what we just, this amazing building that we walked into 15 minutes ago?
Well, it's been a long journey, again, just like everything else, right? We got busy. We started soliciting donations. We learned how to write grants. I'd never written a grant before in my life, and we wrote grants, and we just figured out how to make it work, and we were able to start adding equipment and adding therapists, and then word of mouth spread, and we started getting more patients. We were fortunate that because we have a licensed physical therapist that we were able to bill insurance. We could bill Medicaid, Medicare, but our model has always been to give individuals the time that they need to recover, not based on the reimbursement that we get. So if you understand that it's not about NeuroWorks and how much money we can make, it's about getting the people better outcomes, more progress, no matter how long it takes. So fast forward, we'll be 15 years old, and 3.5 years ago, we moved into a custom designed $8 million building that's 24,500 square feet that we had the chance to design. Now, in between, you know, we grew a little bit incrementally. We went from 1,000 square feet to 4,000 square feet, and then made the jump to this bigger building. But yeah, it's been a pretty amazing journey for us. So every day we drive up to this building, we pinch ourselves because we always thought, you know, someday we'd like to have our own place, something we designed. But to drive up to it every day and think it actually exists is pretty amazing.
I think one thing that stood out to me every time I've heard your journey is how you just decided to make things happen. How you were doing some kind of research and saw like an $85,000 contraption on how to like reduce the load so that people could like walk on a treadmill. And so you went to Home Depot and made one for like $250. To me, it screams like you're not going to be denied, right? Like you make a decision and you're going to find any way to make it happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one way you can put it. I think the interesting thing is when I hear you say it that way, I'm not sure at the time I would describe it that way. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
I think sometimes you are just so in the moment that you just, it seems like a natural thing to do. You just say, oh no, this is what we need to do. And so you don't think about it, which is probably good. Cause had we thought about what we were doing,
we might've been overwhelmed.
Well, yeah.
And we
even today we'll have people approach us and say, well, you know, we're thinking about doing this. And we look at each other like, are you sure?
Yeah.
Because yeah, I mean, obviously anything worth doing, you know, if it doesn't challenge you, it doesn't change you kind of thing. And so we've learned a lot. But that was part of the reason I went back to school too, you know, in 2000.
Yeah, you got your master's degree, right?
2009, I went back and got a master's of public administration degree because I realized I was, you know, neck deep in the nonprofit world and didn't quite know how to swim. And
yeah.
So it was kind of like, okay, if we're going to survive, you know, we've got to catch up. And we always joke. I mean, we always joke that you have a partially paralyzed gynecologist and a physical therapist running a nonprofit organization. So that's pretty scary.
Seems like it's working out okay for you guys
so far. Yeah.
How was that transition from being a physician to shifting over to the business world? And tell us a little bit about kind of that role change and what that was like for you.
Well, interestingly enough, when I was injured, I went through a period of time where I really felt like a nothing. I didn't feel like a physician anymore. I felt like I had lost that. I didn't feel like a husband, a father. And it was quite a struggle to figure out, am I really worth anything anymore? And I think that's a very common thing that when people have these kind of injuries where everything's taken away, your independence, the fact that you can even go to the bathroom on your own, you really feel like a modern day leper. And, you know, that was really hard. And I struggled with that even after we started NeuroWorks, that many times I'd say to Jan, I don't feel like a doctor anymore. Even though, you know, technically I am, but it was a hard transition. Now it's easier. And I feel like that I've been able to blend my experience with the nonprofit world and running a small business into what I, you know, to make it all work. Because there are lots of times now that the therapists come to me, ask questions, medical questions, patients will come. And I think my background and knowledge has helped what we do and how we do it. I will also say this one other thing is it's interesting how those two little letters behind my name have opened up many doors. And, you know, be proud of those two little letters. For example, a number of years ago, we decided that we needed to try and do some legislation from on a state level. So I called the director of the Department of Health, who at that time was David Sundwall. And I said, hi, this is Dr. Hall. I'd like to make an appointment with Dr. Sundwall. Oh, of course. Well, not everybody can do that, right? Yeah. So, you know, those kind of privileges I don't take for granted.
So I watched your TED talk to, I guess, try and pick some things that really stood out to me to talk about. And I think the one thing you said that you said even surprised yourself was that if you could go back and avoid the injury, but you'd lose everything that you've learned in the process, that you wouldn't go back and change it. Right. And so I'm curious as to what a few of those lessons are that have changed your life or blessed your life so much that you would do it all over again.
Ooh, that's probably a big question. Obviously this whole experience has changed me. In some ways I think I'm a much better person. I think I'm more in touch with, the humanity side of our existence. I'll give you an example. It wasn't uncommon after my accident, say 3 or 4 years after my accident, that I would see people with a disability, maybe in a wheelchair, and I had this really strong urge that I just wanted to go up and touch them and greet them and reassure them. And I don't know where that came from. I don't know if it was that I now identified with them, or I don't know if it was sympathy, empathy. I don't know what it was, but it was this very overwhelming feeling. I don't think I would ever have developed that. I would have said before, yeah, I think I'm fairly sympathetic and empathetic. I mean, I tried to be kind and a good listener as a physician, but it's a whole nother level of what I feel about people. And I think certainly love, in terms of those feelings I have for my family and the little things of life, you know, that personal independence. So I think, to summarize, if I can, the best way I could describe it is, it's probably given me a depth to my soul that I wouldn't have otherwise have had the opportunity to have. Maybe the analogy is, you know, you meet somebody that you really love and you get married and you just think, oh my gosh, you know, I can't love this person. How could I love anybody more? And then you have a child and you're like, oh my gosh, you know, and it doesn't make your love bigger. It just makes it
deeper.
And to explain to people what it's like to have children who don't have children, you fumble for the words.
I think one of the, huge takeaways that Sam and I got from some of your other talks that you gave us were the things that you learned as a patient that you've then been able to take into your practice now and teach other healthcare providers about what it was like to be on the other side of the bed.
Yeah, being a patient is hard. You know, I understood all the medical side of it. I knew you had to do this test and this procedure, but I think the most difficult part is realizing that you are subordinating yourself to other people. And I think we forget about that. I think you forget that when you're in a hospital or under someone's care, because most of us don't, I mean, the general public, we don't even understand the whys and the whats, right? But just to give yourself up and know that this person who's a total stranger, you're now saying, okay, you take care of me. That's really hard. And I think we forget about how difficult that is for people to be a patient. Obviously, the sense of touch is the thing that was most profound for me.
And how did you realize that again? Could you tell the story of how you kind of came to that conclusion based on your experiences?
Well, obviously, initially I had no sense of touch below the level of my shoulders. No light touch, no pain, no pinprick, temperature, anything. And the first thing that actually did come back was light touch, which was really kind of a weird situation. But as I talked about, when I was in the hospital, I really lost my sense of self-worth and didn't feel like a worthwhile human being. And I even worried about what the nurses said about me when they did their change of shifts. I mean, I could envision, I mean, I've stood around board rounds, you know, I know what sometimes gets said about certain patients. And so I for whatever reason, I started to ruminate on this of, you know, I'm just this person down in room such and such, and nobody wants to take care of me or anything. So as I was going through that for several weeks, I had a couple of nurses who seemed to give me reassurance, but I couldn't figure out why. So I started to pay attention, and I thought, well, is it their personality? Is it what they did, how they did it? And I noticed that before they would leave my room, after they had finished taking care of me, they would stop, put a hand on my shoulder where I could feel, and then they would say, is there anything else I can do for you? And I initially believed it was because they asked, which allowed me to be in control. But then I realized that other people did that too. But then it dawned on me, it was the fact that they put their hand where I could feel. And I realized that patients are typically only touched when there is a task to be performed. Medicating, bathing, moving, whatever, therapy. When the nurses touched me, when they didn't have to, it communicated to me that I was an acceptable human being to them. So I actually coined the term non-task touching because I now believe and realize that there is a power in touch that we underestimate, and certainly in medicine, that there's an enormous amount of communication that takes place that can either be good or it can be bad, but it can be very reassuring when it's done in that non-task environment. And that really provided a lot of comfort to me that, oh, they, you know, they think I'm okay. And they probably didn't even realize that they were doing it.
I think that's an incredible takeaway for all of our listeners. That's something that all of us can do a better job of when we're interacting with patients. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your Master's of Public Administration. I know you mentioned you gave a little bit of a pitch for MPAs versus MBAs, and I'd love to hear more about it.
Well, as I said when I spoke to your group, I'm really anxious about where healthcare is going, as a lot of people are. And I really feel strongly that we need young physicians who are going to be part of the conversation. And I think in the past, we've had a lot of physicians who have gone on to get dual degrees. A lot of them have gotten masters of business administration and have jumped into the business side of healthcare, which is now a huge industry. You have physicians who get masters of public health, but my concern is that we need young physicians who are going to drive public policy, who are going to help the whole healthcare dilemma of how do we get equitable care to everybody in the best way. And it's nothing, I don't have anything against MBAs. My concern is we just have plenty of MBAs already who are running healthcare. What we need is people who look at it from the equity humanitarian side so that we can sustain what needs to happen in the best way possible. So when I went back and got a master's of public administration, it made me realize there were things I didn't have any concept about. And it really changed my thought processes about how you think through a problem, how you think about how do you take care of a city, how do you take care of a municipality or a state in government terms. And obviously MPA, a lot of people do government service when they get the degree, but they also focus on nonprofit. My point is that it's not necessarily the degree itself. It's the fact of how you think about a problem. An MBA tends to think about bottom line, profit margin. MPA is that idea of equitable services for everybody in an economical, efficient fashion. You could get a Master's of Public Policy, which is now available. There's also Master's of Healthcare Administration, which is out there. All those things I think are great, and that's what I would encourage some of you to do.
For students who are interested in an MPA or some other dual degree, I'm curious, do you have any recommendations on doing your second degree during your medical degree, or do you think there is some value to having a few years of practice and then doing your MPA?
I guess what I would say is get your medical training and do a really, make that your focus, because there is so much for you all to learn. I mean, I think about the fact that, so I graduated in 1985. When you think about how much knowledge has occurred between 85 and 2019, but you all have the same amount of time, right? Yeah. I'm actually amazed that you're able to get through in 4 years, to be honest with you. So your first obligation is to become superb physicians and then take that and move on. What I would hate to see is you become mediocre physicians and dilute the whole effort, because you just need to be really good at what you do and have a great understanding of it. So I guess I would probably recommend maybe doing it later. I think you could, in certain cases, do it together, depending on you know, the path that you wanted to follow.
What about, aside from graduate programs, do you have any recommendations for medical students on how they can get involved with public policy, or what they can be doing to start learning about these things now and be kind of, I guess, grow to become aware physicians?
Well, I don't know what your curriculum provides in medical school. I mean, there's not a lot of time to crowd anything else in there. I think my recommendation is just, for the time being, try and keep a little bit of your ear to the ground. You know, what is happening in healthcare in terms of public policy? What direction is the ship going? What do we think is going to happen in the future? To some degree, that's going to affect you anyway, because as you come out of your residency training or out of medical school, employment becomes an important part. And the question is, how do you want to be employed? In my day and time, it was common practice that you go out and start your own practice, right? I mean, that was the common method. I think majority now, individuals come out looking for a job in a corporate position, which is great. I'm not saying that's with a critical nature, but it's different. And I think you need to understand where healthcare is going to be, because it's going to affect your job, your lifestyle, your retirement. And it's also going to affect your ability to provide the care that you want to give to those that you take care of.
That's amazing advice, especially coming from somebody who has been on both sides of the healthcare system. I'm curious, what are some of the things that you've found liberating being outside of an institution telling you how you can practice? What are some things that you have learned being able to kind of dictate how you deliver healthcare here compared to the, you have to see X amount of patients a day, this is standard protocol for this, that, and the other. What are some things that maybe we should be thinking about as we are seeing patients in the hospital of maybe there's a better way to do this?
Well, let me put it this way. This may not exactly what you're asking, but one of the things that Jan and I realize is, and this will sound a little bit funny, but the physical paralysis is the easy part. Because these people that come to us are paralyzed emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, financially, mentally. And nobody or the system doesn't provide any sort of care for those aspects of paralysis. So one of the things that we really take pride in and we're happy about is helping those individuals through those aspects of paralysis. So let me give you a specific. If you're in a situation and your healthcare says, so let's say you have a spinal cord injury tomorrow and you come out of the hospital and you're still paralyzed and you have hope, right? You like, I want to go to rehab. I want to work hard. I want to get better. And you look at your insurance benefits and they say, okay, you get 30 outpatient PT visits and 30 outpatient OT visits. And you burn those visits up and then you go to the insurance company and say, but I'm still making progress. Can I have some more visits? And they go, nope, that's, you know, here's your wheelchair. Have a nice life. What we see is that that builds resentment and bitterness in people. And so suddenly those people, their attitude is, well, if I'm going to be the victim, I'm going to play the victim's role. So I'm just going to sit home and feel sorry for myself. It doesn't empower them, right? So one of the things that we like about what we do is we lay out a treatment plan. And sometimes Jan describes it as the bucket list. We let them work as long as hard as they want to. If they want to try certain things, as long as it's safe, we let them try it. Because it's important that they become satiated. And eventually, what we see is those individuals get to the point where they realize, okay, maybe this is the best I'm going to get. They may not be happy with that. But if they've had the opportunity to try and to push and to try everything possible, it's much easier for them to say, okay, I've given it my very best. What's next? And now we see those people go on. And some of our most favorite stories are people who still use a chair for mobility and they've gone on to do incredible things. Why? Well, maybe we haven't made them physically walk, but we've made their spirits walk. And so I think some of the healing that we look for in medicine, we kind of miss the boat on that because making people's spirits walk, so to speak.
Yeah, we're so focused on the physical that we neglect some very important aspects of what makes that person who they are.
Exactly. So if you can capture that in whatever practice that you do, I think you'll be the exception. You'll be in that 1%. You'll be in the Osler Hall of Fame, you know.
That is really powerful advice. I'm speechless, I think.
what's crazy to me is it's stuff that if we locked ourselves in a room and thought about what's going to make a really good physician, right? We could probably come up with some of these answers, but hearing it from somebody who actually lives it and kind of stepping back and seeing the impact that can have on patients, it's hard not to be motivated and inspired to kind of, I don't know, do things differently, right? So I hope I can remember this conversation and remember these lessons that I'm learning right now when I'm, you know, dog tired, beat up on the wards and, you know, seeing my umpteenth patient for the day, that I can have that perspective of this person isn't their diagnosis, right? This is a person with a diagnosis, and how can we kind of help all aspects of that patient grow and recover?
We talked about kind of your journey and a lot of the goals that help keep you going. And I'm curious, in 2019, what are you thinking about? What are your top priorities? What goals do you have for yourself or for NeuroWorks? What would you like to see happen over the next few months or years?
Well, as I went through my rehab, my motto, that I developed for myself was pleased but not satisfied. And the reason that came about was as I was working with Jan, I was making all this progress, and she would show up for therapy and she would say, how come you don't act excited about all this progress you're making? Well, the problem was I was so worried that if I celebrated that it would stop. So I said to her, well, I'm pleased, but I'm not satisfied, which kept me working and moving down the road. And so unfortunately, or fortunately, whichever you want to look at, that same thing has driven what Jan and I do with NeuroWorks. So, you know, we are extremely proud of where we are now, but we have a whole list of things that we want to see happen. And in fact, this is our year that we're pushing hard to improve our infrastructure, enlarge our infrastructure, because, you know, we want to be more active legislatively. We want to do more clinical research. We want to expand our programs. We want to be more relevant in the spinal cord, in the paralysis community, not only spinal cord, but brain injury. In other words, we want to be able to contribute to the body of knowledge in terms of rehab. And we feel like we've been doing this long enough that we can legitimately say, hey, this is what we're doing. We think it works. Can we make this happen in other places? How can we share this and move the whole ball of wax forward? So, and I think that's what keeps driving us. You know, we were able to get some legislation passed in Utah that funds post-acute therapy. And we have other people from other states calling us now saying, how in the heck did you get that done?
Yeah.
So those are the kind of things that drive us.
Well, I think if any of our listeners, or, you know, me or Sam, can listen to this and not be inspired to make some kind of a difference, I don't know how that's possible. I'm sitting here and my mind is just running on how bright the future of medicine could really be if we all took the initiative to see a problem, solve a problem, and just help people. Like, you're so inspiring, and it's cool to just sit here across from you and see your eyes light up when you talk about the things that you've accomplished, but the things that you are going to accomplish. Like, it's cool.
Well, thanks. I mean, that's very kind. You know, I just hope that you guys can do it without having to have a catastrophic injury. So, and that's the weird thing, is I realize how much it's blessed my life. You know, NeuroWorks blesses my life. The people that I meet are the most amazing people, and I would have never had the opportunity to meet them. And, you know, that I think that's the other thing that drives the whole thing along. And you're going to have that experience in your practice. But as you said, sometimes it's hard when, you know, when you're tired and things are frustrating and you're like, oh my gosh, you know, I just can't do it one more day. But you do. And you guys will be dedicated physicians, and you'll figure it out. But I also think, I think there's something to be said about taking time to stop and think. You know, medicine is a very demanding mistress, so to speak. And there's always going to be one more thing to do, your busyness is going to overwhelm you. So I would encourage you to at least take some time to stop occasionally and think about, okay, where am I? You know, what am I doing? Is there a bigger picture? You know, what can I do differently? I think that's really important. I don't know if you've ever been camping in a wilderness area where it's so quiet you can hear the quiet.
Yeah.
I never understood that until I experienced it. And I think there's a place for that. Sometimes in medicine, you need to get to a place where all the distractions go away and you listen to the quiet and say, all right, what do I really want to find meaning with?
Awesome. Awesome advice. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this with us. I have no doubt this is going to help a lot of people. And we're sure grateful for you taking the time and sharing your experiences with us. And I know that it's going to help me and Sam for sure, but hopefully a lot of other people that end up hearing this and going into healthcare.
Well, I certainly hope so. Meeting people like you too makes me optimistic about medicine, and that's good. You know, good people will always do good things, and that's the most important thing. So thanks for being good people.
Oh, we really appreciate it. I can tell this is going to be one of those episodes that I come back to first year residency, second year residency, just to remind myself, because I think this was just chock full of incredibly invaluable advice. And thanks to everyone at home for listening. We'll see you next time.